In some ways, I find the final parshas in Bamidbar the most exciting. Jewish people are making their final preparations to enter the land of Israel. Last week, they conquered the principal adversaries that stood in the way of crossing the Jordan, Sihon and Og. Next week, they'll begin their military strategies, and this week, in Parshas Pinchas, a new leader is appointed. Yehoshua is the new commander-in-chief, and not only that, but the stories of the daughters of Tzlovchad, it goes one step further, because Moshe established the guidelines for how the division of the land is ultimately going to unfold. So for anyone who loves Eretz Yisrael, even amid the 3 weeks when we acknowledge our distance from the ideal state of affairs in the Holy Land, it's not a coincidence that we're afforded the hope and anticipation to drive our yearning that is the essential focus of this period. Now the process of dividing the land is outlined at length in the Gemara in Baba Basra, in the parak named Yesh Nochlin, and it's part of the overall subject of ownership and inheritance and halacha that's described there. But there is a major quirk in the way the system is designed that's going to sound strange to you. In fact, the Gemara actually acknowledges that it's strange. Mishuna nachlazu mikol nachla shavolam. The land was inherited in a way that differs from all other inheritance. That's what the Gemara says. To illustrate this quirk, let's give an example. There's two brothers, Reuven and Shimon, who left Mitzrayim. No, they didn't enter the land because we know they were punished. They didn't get that far. But Reuven had one son, and Shimon had three sons, and all four did enter the land. So that's a total of four portions up for grabs. The Gemara says that these four portions are actually assigned to their fathers, Reuven and Shimon, right? Two and two. So Reuven's one son gets two portions in the land, and Shimon's sons, three sons, have to split two portions. Now that's all the math we're going to do, but think about that. In essence, when the Jews entered Israel, the land was divided in a way that did not recognize those, the pioneers, the chalutzim, the first generation Israelis, if you will, as the primary stakeholders, but instead their parents are named with the title, even though that title was immediately transferred to the next generation, because the first generation was already gone. Now, why would we do that? Why would we do that? There was once a man, his name was Nastasio Vespuccio. Have you ever heard of him? No, of course not. You definitely heard of his son, Amerigo Vespucci, because the latter was an explorer whose discoveries had a serious impact in establishing the New World. But his father? It would hardly be intuitive to name our country, or continent for that matter, for someone who probably never even saw it. But that's what's going on over here, and that's what we need to understand. I want to digress briefly for a moment to share a story I read this week that really struck me. There's a pasuk we say every morning. It's also the makeup of the most popular Sephardic song, Habibi. David HaMelech says, Ki chizak she'arayach, berach b'nayach b'kirvach. The simple meaning is, it's a prayer that Hashem strengthen our boundaries, that the gates of Yerushalayim should be strong to protect the people who reside in its midst. Yaakov Yamnetz explained that it also has more personal implications. Ki chizak she'arayach means in our own homes, our she'arim, within our gates, we have to create a secure environment. If we want to see Beirach Banim Bekirbech, the true blessing for our children, that's what it takes to create a secure environment at home. A noted contemporary Jewish educator reflected on this simple teaching, updating with a modern spin. He said, I've seen mothers walking their toddlers, and while the child is speaking, the mother's face is elsewhere, focused on the screen. Years ago, I had a meeting with parents about their son, who was displaying chutzpah and disregarding the yeshiva's rules. Mid-meeting, the father suddenly takes out his phone and begins to read text messages. And at that moment, I felt such pity for the son. Of course, he can't learn the proper behavior in a home where that's what goes on. What struck me was a new angle in appreciating the other Mechaveiro challenges that we have to overcome in a world of technology. We want our children, grandchildren, to be respectful. And yet, we have an area in which, a new area, in which we may inadvertently fail in that regard. And that's what's passed on, because our phone habits can be poor exemplars of the mitzvahs that we want the next generation to imbibe. I haven't been able to get that image out of my head, this father at the meeting with the principal. And even the smallest things can have significant impact in what goes on to the next generation. But on the flip side, it can also be something so encouraging. And that's the answer of her question too, based on something once shared by Rabbi Yaakov Neuberger. Of course, we would imagine that all of the accolades of settling the land of Israel should go to that first generation who crossed the Jordan River and on their own 2 feet erected a Mishkan for years of battles to conquer the country and spent years creating its tribal infrastructure, and each one should receive a parcel of land with his or her name on it. And however and forever, we would think of the founding fathers in Judaism, right, as the heads of the households named in today's parsha in the final census of those who would possess Eretz Israel. And yet, Hashem said otherwise. Hashem said that every tract of land would be assigned by name to someone from a generation earlier, someone who never merited to see the land, and yet toiled under Egyptian servitude, witnessed the miracles of Exodus, and throughout dreamed of the promised land, even though those individuals never made it there. In my mind, it conjures up memories of traveling through Europe, and you know, if you go into the shuls that remain, Poland, Lithuania, almost without fail, every shul has painted next to the Aron Kodesh, the Kotel, Kever Rachel, Maariv HaMachpelah, images of landmarks for whom those davening those shuls could never have dreamed of coming even near to. And yet they hoped. It's where they directed their tefillah, so to speak. It brings to mind chapters of Leon Uris' classic book, Exodus. On the one hand, you know, those pioneers 125 years ago and more who insisted that Israel would bear fruit, return to its glory, and as they dredged the swamps and warded off mosquitoes with malaria. You know, so many of them died long before 1948. But the dream was there. The dream was there, and the next generation grew up in their parents' laps and embraced with a vision of what could be. You know, I got the Aliyah earlier this morning, the 8 a.m. minyan. The Aliyah that says that the whole generation died out. The whole generation, 40 years, no one was left. And I have to say, I got a little choked up. But it doesn't mean it was all for naught. Because the generation crossed the Jordan. The next generation crossed the Jordan. And they brought with them the nevuah of the reality that they fulfilled in their lifetimes the promises made by Hashem, the dreams of their parents who lived through Egypt with that vision of the fulfillment of the promises by Hashem to Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. But it was the generation of the slave room in Yetzias Mitzrayim that instilled the values that formed the impetus for that next generation to bring it to fruition. HaKadosh Baruch Hu, with a system that may seem counterintuitive at first, was actually quite deliberate in establishing the division of the land as he did. Hashem wants the names of those who did not make it to Israel to forever be emblazoned on every stone and bush, every farm and every sabra orchard, so the spirit of settling the land would be as inextricably linked to the land as those who actually settled it. Because it was that influence that made the next generation the generation of the settlers. And so they too had a share, perhaps the lion's share, of the inheritance of the land because they inspired it. When we reflect on our lives and what's important to us, we inevitably come back to those whom we were inspired by and whose examples and values were influential, especially when they came across through behavior and not just through teachings. Leaders can be taught, or they can be untaught by the way we behave, as that self-fulfilling story indicates. But the Torah counterbalances that realization with a positive spin, that there are holy values that can be imparted as well. Our aspirations communicate what is important to us, and we may not always be privy to see how that inspiration will play out. But when we make an effort to ensure that the messages are the right ones, those messages and their impacts will be everlasting.